Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Rosie Robards.
And I'm Kendall Stormo. Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Our theme for this show is change of pace.
We'll hear stories of setting out, expanding horizons, and breaking barriers.
First, we'll share a story told by Alaska-grown Eric Rogers. It's a look back on his life as a young musician.
So when I was a very young person, I was watching Star Wars with my dad, and I heard the violins in the theme song, and that. I had to learn how to do that. Took a few years, but eventually my parents got me into lessons and I started playing, and that was all I did growing up. I locked myself in my room and I practiced for hours and hours and hours on end. Made you a pretty decent little musician, not exactly the most world-renowned, like, extrovert. So when I was in college, I was studying violin performance, and I was working one summer up here at a music camp for kids, and they're bringing some friends of mine up from Austin, Texas, and these guys were good. It was my friend James, who was a freak of nature before he went and got his master's in London in like contemporary violin performance, and my friend Adam, who was an amazing guitar player, sassy as all get by, and loved to drink beer. So I wanted to be them in like one way or another. And I was completely honored. They asked me to sit in for a couple shows while they were in town, just to kind of make the trip a little bit more economical. The shows in question were two yoga classes. The first one, the first one was geared toward dancers. The second one was for the general public. And we thought, odd. But when you're a young musician, you take every gig you can get. So we show up, we are unpacking our instruments, kind of warming up in the front lobby, and I'm talking to a lady, and she's very excited for the opportunity to have tango music, very excited that we're here, and really excited to get home for dinner. What's for dinner? Oh, I just had a daughter a few weeks ago, and we're having the placenta tonight. Huh? Yeah, it's in the freezer. And like, this is one of those moments where your world just gets exponentially bigger, whether you are willing for it to or not. So I just did the only thing I could think of, and I asked, why? And she goes, oh, it happens in nature all the time. It's to bond me with my daughter. Happens all the time. Luckily, class was starting, and that is where the conversation ended, because I was just too scared to continue. Make our way into the studio. The three of us make our way into the corner, because obviously that's where a tango band and a yoga class should go. But we're kind of throwing a curveball. The instructor goes, okay, dancers, partner up with your musicians. I look across the room, and I see Placenta Lady. She's looking back at me. And I panicked. I ran away. I grabbed the nearest human being I could that was not her. Just instinct kicked in. And we were told, musicians play music, dancers respond. I thought, okay, my parents didn't raise no quitter. I'm a professional. They hired a tango band, I'll start playing tango music. Started playing. She started dancing. It's this point that I should note her background was a little bit more exotic than anything I'd really experienced at that time. I mean, here I am, this 20-year-old kid. Like, I'd been doing ballroom dance and salsa, but I'd never experienced a full-grown, latter 20s-year-old woman just moving her body with, like, that confidence that a woman of that, like, age really has. And she is not breaking eye contact. I I'm looking across the room at my bandmates, and they're actually having like a really interesting kind of artistic conversation between their partners, and kind of felt a little bit jealous because I'm over here trying to make tango music not sensual, which is darn near impossible when you have the gypsy temptress as your partner. We get to the second class, though, and this one, it's the general public. Maybe we're supposed to just play music in the corner? We start making our way that way. Nope. We are told to line up on one end of the yoga studio and make the art of our soul as we sashay across to the other side. I don't know that song. I leaned over to Adam and just, what do I play? He leans back to me, the art of your soul. In B flat. You're such a good bandmate, thank you. And something about the four walls of this yoga studio just let everybody's inner just come right out. At one point, there's a woman collapsed on the floor throwing a temper tantrum. There's another woman in the corner speaking in tongues, I think. She is definitely, though, having an argument with herself, and she's definitely losing, and she's pissed. All good things, though, must come to an end. And thankfully, this class did. And we decided the only way that we could truly heal from this experience was protein and beer. And we ended up at Humpy's, and we're just kind of sitting there staring at our beverages, just not saying a whole lot, except James. James actually was pretty chatty during that whole, he just, oh, that's an amazing artistic opportunity to expand my creative bounds. We finish up dinner and decide, hey, you know what? Let's get out of here. Let's go back to the cabin, fill some growlers, and just play music till 3 a.m, because, yeah. And on our way out, this mountain of a bouncer just intercepts us, and he is right in our face. And I don't want to deal with a bouncer on a good day, like on the receiving end of a bouncer particularly. And he's just, where are you guys going? You guys have, are those instruments on your backs? What are you doing? You guys in a band? You wanna play a gig? Can you play a gig? We've our band didn't show up. We need a band right now. Saturday night at Humpy's. We're a tango trio. Not exactly musica con grada. But when you're a young musician just starting out, take every gig you can get. Thank you.
That was Eric Rogers. These days you can catch him playing with Anchorage Band's High Lonesome Sound and the Hot Club of Nunaka.
We're hearing true stories told by Alaskans. This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
Our next storyteller, Laura Lundell, recently moved back to Anchorage and has been reacquainting herself with what it means to be Alaskan.
Here she is on stage at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
So I was one of those kids, one of those Alaskan kids that grows up here with no real appreciation for the place, saying they're going to leave as soon as they can, get out, see the world. It's just too cold up here, too far away, isolated from the rest of the world. So I really got out. So I left 11 years, and now I've lived in 6 countries and 4 different states, and I was looking for something different. I was looking for someplace a little warmer. My parents had originally moved up here from California. They'd come up on their honeymoon, and after starting a family in California, they moved up permanently in 89, and we traveled a few times just to visit family on the West Coast every few years, but not nearly as much as I really had a desire to. And when I was 16, I told my dad, Dad, when I turn 18 and I'm graduated high school, I'm out of here. I'm out. I'm done. And he told me later that he was offended by me saying that at the time. But when it came time to actually leave and I was doing what I was going to say, he said, I would have kicked you out if you hadn't gone. So true to my word, I left, and I kind of had a keen fascination with the Wild West. So I thought Wyoming would be a good spot. there, did my 4 years. But when I was done, I wasn't quite ready to go back to Alaska. It was still kind of too familiar, too many other places that my eyes had kind of been opened up to and wanted to see. So I somehow got in my head that Tennessee might be a cool spot. I heard that the Smokies were beautiful, and hey, mountains, I like mountains. And I kind of had it was ripe with Southern culture, and that was kind of my newest cultural fascination at the time. So off I went, found myself in Knoxville, substitute teaching in a kindergarten classroom, and so one day I complimented this little black girl on her hair and said, "Oh, I like your braids today." "Miss Lindale, you call them dreads." I felt like that ignorant white girl from Alaska, but it was definitely one of those experiences that I will never forget. And it was the Smokies were beautiful, but it was really hard not consciously comparing them to the mountains of home and getting to the top of a mountain and feeling like you're actually on top of a mountain, not on a tree-lined ridge. But it was a good years there. But I kind of had a desire to, I knew I wanted to teach overseas. And China had never been on my list, but a job opening was posted, and I applied, and things kind of just fell into place. So I found myself on a flight to Shanghai, and they dropped me off at my apartment first, dropped my stuff off, went to the school, filled out some paperwork, and then they give me a printout of a Google map printout of the city, or just that area where I was in, and they weren't going to take me home, nothing. So I'm looking at this map, it's all in Chinese, and I'm like, okay, well, if I just like get my point of reference, I might be able to get back home. So that was kind of the start. Like, here I was in the most populous city in the world, so we're 24 million people, and this girl from Alaska just, you know, squishing onto the subway to get to work, and trying to avoid the smell of stinky tofu cooking, and getting the best and the cheapest food I've ever had, and trying not to get ripped off at the fake markets. It's always fun. And 1 year turned into two. And that summer, I went home, and the next year I was coming back, and it felt like I was going home. And that feeling surprised me, because I had read good student taught originally in Guatemala, and I heard North American teachers from all over just say, you know, I have no desire to return back to, you know, Canada or the U.S. or wherever they were from. And I didn't understand that at the time. I mean, not that I was homesick for Alaska specifically, but just for familiarity, it started to feel lonely. But that second year in China, it was like, oh, I get it now. This is so familiar now. And this is my home right now. Not that it will be forever, but here we are. But a few years, I went back to the States, taught English there for a bit, but I still couldn't shake the desire to go abroad once more. So I kind of had the Middle East in the back of my mind. It's one of those places, I mean, you know, we all hear about it regularly, either terrorism or interpretations of Islam or Muslims around the world, including our own country. So, like with China, there were so many stereotypes that I felt like I'd broken in my own mind. So I wanted to see what it was really like. I got a job in teaching in Kuwait. It was all girls, and we used international curriculum, but it respected Islamic traditions. So yeah, I had a class of girls, which was quite a dramatic experience. And I remember I often tried to go out running. I covered up quite a bit, just to be respectful. And I was running one morning, it was a Friday morning, their holy day, so pretty quiet. Tried to get up before it got to 120 degrees, too hot. I mean, I was looking for somewhere warmer, but that was kind of pushing it. And going off on a quiet street, and all of a sudden, I see this blood pooling in the street. And I kind of slow down, like, that fear starts to hit you a little bit. But then I'm like, no, I feel pretty safe here. Like, you get stared at a lot, you kind of get used to that. But I felt pretty safe after a while. But so this blood is, I'm like, what? So I just peeked behind into this courtyard, and there was a family standing in the courtyard quietly, and there was a lamb that they had just slaughtered. And I remembered that it was Eid. And I was like, wow, this is like raw culture right here. This is what I came to see. This is what I wanted, and now I'm here experiencing it. So I just briefly observed and quietly and went on my way. Another experience that sticks out to me, one of my students' parents, she was also a teacher, and she was always the last one to pick up her student, and here she was. She She always had a niqab on. I never saw her face, and she... We always had some good conversations. She had a class of boys, I had a class of girls, you know, different stories. I'm not sure who had it worse. And there was one time that we had gotten a warning from the embassy. We kind of got those a few times, and just saying, you know, be careful. There was a threat made online to Westerners, or Americans specifically, that just be careful. So the school had upped their security measures, and she was a little miffed that it was in this situation. It was a little bit harder to get in the school property that day. And so I explained to her why it was a little bit harder that particular day, and she said, "Miss Laura, I'm so sorry." She's like, "You know, we are scared of the same people you are." It was in that moment I was like, this is uniting us together here, this woman from a completely different culture, but here we were. And Kuwait never quite started to feel like home like China had. So I started to think more about Alaska that year, and going home. And as time and circumstance would have it, I just moved back in July, and I surprised myself probably more than anyone else. Maybe my dad too, but this time he's not kicking me out. And moving on from teaching, going back to school, and you know, Alaska's changed. And more importantly, I've changed. And as much as I still think about places and I want to go see and travel more, I'm happy to be back and happy that Alaska will always be home.
You just heard from Laura Lundell. During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short, 7-minute stories about their lives. Our theme is change of pace.
Next, we have Chrissy Sloan from Talkeetna. She first told this story at one of our Arctic Entries roadshows. Here she is on stage at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
So mine is also a teaching story. Before, I'm a teacher in Talkeetna, so tomorrow I have to face a ton of little children. Before I taught in Talkeetna, I taught in the inner city in Newark. And when I got there, I quickly realized I had no clue what I was doing. And I remember we were training before the kids got there, and one of the teachers told me, his name was Mr. Jones, he said, "You know, if you ever have any trouble in your classroom, just call me, I'll come over and help you out." And I was like, yeah, whatever, you know, sure, mm-hmm. And it was about the second week of school, and I had given the kids an assignment. And I should preface this, too, with saying that where I taught, it was about 90% African American. I was one of the only white people in the school. And I had given them an assignment to go home and ask their parents about their name. And they came back, and they were reporting to me how they did. And one girl got up. Her name was Akaya, and she said, "Well, I was named after my great-great-grandpa." And we were like, "Oh, great," you know, we all clapped, and then she sat down. And then it was later in the day. I had the kids in the afternoon for about 2.5 hours, and I would always say that I could keep them under control for the first hour, and the last hour and a half was a show. And so it got to the second hour, and I had a girl, Shidavia, passing out papers, and I was kind of by Zakiya, and Shidavia came up to her, and she whispered something to her, and then I heard Zakiya say something back, and then I heard, "Oh, yeah? Well, your great-great-grandpa is dead." And then Zakiya screamed bloody murder, jumped up out of her seat, and I was scrambling over desks, chairs to get to her. I grabbed her before she could get to Shidavia, and she was fighting me, and I was screaming, "Go get Mr. Jones! Go get Mr. Jones!" And he heard me screaming and came in, and he said, "Oh no, what's going on in here?" And the guy was screaming, "She said my great-great-grandpa was dead." And I'll never forget, he said, "Well, girl, he is dead. Let's go." And he hauled her out. And so then it was later in the year. It was about this time of year. And as any teacher knows, that when it gets around Christmas break, the holidays, kids go crazy. And it was the afternoon, and I was in the back of the class. I don't know what I was doing. I hardly ever knew what I was doing. But and I saw Zakiah and Shadevia up at the front, and I just heard, "Oh, yeah?" And I screamed, "Go get Mr. Jones!" And it was like deja vu. It was the same story all over again. She was screaming, I was holding her back, and he came in, and she was yelling, she said, "My great-great-grandpa was dead." And he goes, "Oh, no, girl! Is this about your great-great-grandpa again? Let's go!" And he hauled her out. And so this was later in the year, and I should preface this story with Mr. Jones wasn't there this day. So I knew I was on my own. And things quickly got out of control. It was crazy. And the kids were going crazy, and I had no idea what to do. And there was an aide in the room, and he didn't know either. And so all of a sudden, I said, "Everybody sit down. I have something to tell you." And so they all were like, "All right, whatever." So they sat down. And then I said, "Listen, I haven't told you this before, but I can tell fortunes. And the only way it works is if you're quiet. I have to have complete silence to work." And the kids are like, So they sit down and I say, "All right, if you want your fortune to be read, line up. I'll do it." So the first girl came up and I told her that she was going to be a travel writer and that her favorite place was going to be Ireland because she was going to meet a boy there named Kevin O'Shea. And he would become her husband. And so all the kids were laughing and, you know, they were like, No, Kevin's Miss Sloan. And I was like, "Well, this is what I see, guys. This is what I see." And so then another girl came up, and I told her she was going to be a math professor. And she said, "But I hate math." And I said, again, I was like, "Cheyenne, I have no control over this, okay? This is a gift. It was passed down to me from my great-great-grandma. And I just tell you what I see." So another boy came up, and his name was Coffrey, and I remember Coffrey really wanted to play football. And I said, "Well, you know, Coffrey, I hate to break it to you, but I don't see you playing in the NFL." And he was like, "Oh, man." And I said, "But I do see you being a commentator for the football shows. Yeah, I'm a real football fan, you can tell." And so he was like, "Oh, that's awesome." He's like, "Cool." And so I went through, but I'll never forget, there was one girl who didn't come up to get her fortune read, and her name was Khadijah, and she came up to me later, and she said, "Miss Sloan, I know that you can't read fortunes." And I said, "Oh, no, Khadijah. Yes, I can. It's a great skill." And she said, "No, I know that you can't read fortunes." And she stared at me. She said, "I know you can't read fortunes because you didn't say any of us were going to be crack addicts. And you didn't say any of us were going to have babies at 15. And you didn't say any of us were going to get shot dead in the street." And when she said that, I felt shame. I felt shame like I had never felt before because I had just wanted the kids to be quiet. I wanted them to behave. And I thought I was doing something fun with them, but really, I so missed the reality of their lives that I just felt shame. And after that, kids in other classes had heard that I had done that with my one class, and they wanted me to do it, but I said, "Oh no, you know, it comes and it goes." And it left, and because I just couldn't do it, because I was so ashamed of what I had done. And I think about that story often, and I think about it now particularly because I think about what we're going through in the United States, what we're going through in the world right now, and I think about Khadija, and I really want her to grow up in a world where she could believe in the fortunes that I told. Thank you very much.
That was Chrissy Sloan, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
Just a quick reminder that all past Arctic Entries stories are available for listening on our website at arcticentries.com, as well as on iTunes and SoundCloud.
Our next storyteller comes to us from Storyworks Alaska, a program that offers workshops in high school English classes.
This show actually features two high school-age storytellers. Ole Fair, a student from West Anchorage High School, will share his story first. Here he is.
So at the beginning of last summer, my mom signed me and my brother Mac up for Winter Stars, which is a training program for cross-country skiers. And neither me nor my brother Mac cross-country ski, but we both play ice hockey, which is a winter sport, just like skiing, so we don't have much to do in the summer. And so she thought it would be a good opportunity for us to just get some exercise and stay in shape for hockey season. And so we thought, all right, great, it'll be something to do in the summer, and it sounds like loads of fun. So, and it was about 6 days a week, 2 to 3 hours a day of different activities and exercises. Sometimes it was roller skiing or hill training or trail running, and it was made out to be this super intense, hardcore program. And the first few days we went, I was kind of surprised because it was like relatively easy. And I had lots of fun, though, and it made me feel great about myself because I could do all the things that they were telling me to, and I could keep up with the rest of the group. And but as time went on, it got progressively harder. And about 2 to 3 weeks in, every time I went, I would totally exhaust myself. I'd be panting and sweating and 3 miles behind everyone else, and I couldn't keep up with anyone, and they just all looked like they were out on a Saturday stroll, and it was kind of embarrassing. And the coach, his name is Jan Byrne, and he's about 5 feet tall. He's a Polish, and he has a very thick accent. And he would always be yelling at us, and I think it was motivational, but I couldn't tell because he didn't speak English very well. And so it was kind of scary. And so anyway, it was just not really my type of thing, and I didn't fit in very well, and I never had a lot of fun when I went. So one day, while my brother Mac was driving the two of us out to Kincaid, where the workouts were being held that day, I was just sitting in the car. I was dreading agreeing to sign up for this, and I was thinking out loud. I was just like, oh, I'm really not looking forward to this. I don't want to go. I can't wait till it's over. And my brother pipes in from across the car. He's like, we could just not go. And if I was kind of shocked at first. I was like, oh, our mom's going to find out. She's going to be totally pissed. We're going to be grounded forever. And, but I was like, oh, it's better than the alternative. So he drives us to the parking lot of Tasty Freeze, which is, it's right down the road from Kincaid. It's like the first public place you see when you're driving out of the park. And, we sit in the parking lot in our car, listen to music for about 30 minutes. And after a while, I'm getting kind of hungry. And I'm like, well, it's Tasty Freeze. It's pretty convenient. And so we both go in and we order cheeseburgers and fries and soda and ice cream, and all while we're supposed to be working out, this is. And we wait for about 2 hours till Winter Stars would have been over. And we start the car up and we go home. And for some reason that day, I thought my mom would know somehow. She didn't have any reason to, but she's the type of parent that always knows everything that we do, and she always catches us whenever we're doing anything bad. And so I walked in the door. I was kind of scared. And but it was just like any other ordinary day, she said cheerfully. When we walked in the door, she said, how's Winter Stars, boys? And we kind of smirked at each other, and we were like, good. like, haha, we tricked Mom. And we did, and she didn't find out. And so the next day, when it was time to go to Winter Stars again, we thought, well, we didn't have to go to workouts, and we got to have a great lunch, and no one found out, and we didn't get any trouble, so why not do it again? So, again, he drives to Tasty Freeze, and we go in, and we eat everything that's on the menu, and about 2 hours pass, and we go back home, and the same thing happens. You know, how's Winter Stars? Oh, it's good, ha, ha, ha. And she never found out. And so it continued for the entire summer. And of course, we widened our horizons past just Tasty Freeze. Eventually, we went out to McDonald's and Arby's and Taco Bell. And by the end of the summer, we had gone to just about every fast food restaurant and every little coffee hut in the city of Anchorage while we were supposed to be working out. And it was great. It was great. And we never had to go to workouts, and we got to eat like kings, and it was amazing. But I remember this one day towards the end of the summer, we took off for Winter Stars. And I think it was Taco King that day. And we had a great lunch. It was going great. We didn't think anything was wrong. And we get home, and I expected it to be just like any other ordinary day. But I walk in the door, and I turn right, and all I see is my mom sitting on the living room couch with her arms crossed and that like death glare that your parents give you whenever they've caught you doing something wrong. And she just says in this super sarcastic tone, she just says, "How was Winter Stars, boys?" And at that point, we knew that she knew that we weren't where we were supposed to be. And I just turned around to Mac and I'm like, "Oh, we're so busted." We got in huge trouble. So what had happened was, at the end of the summer, when it came time for my mom to pay for all these workouts that we had supposed to have been going to, the coach tells my mom, "I understand if you only want to pay half price, because they stopped coming." Of course, at this point, she thought that we had been going all along, so she found out that we had been skipping our duties almost every day of the entire summer, and of course, she didn't want to have to pay for it, and she was pretty pissed, and we got in huge trouble. My mom took my brother's car away for a couple weeks, and not to mention our credit cards, on which we had racked up a huge bill of fast food. We probably spent about $250 that month on fast food, and it was a terrible experience at the time. But looking back on it, I see that me and my brother were really brought together, and it really strengthened our relationship. So it made me and my brother a lot closer through our shared rebellion. Thank you.
That was Oli Fair, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
We're about to hear from another high school student. Juan Martinez Paredes is 16 and also attends West High School. Thanks to Storyworks Alaska for bringing him to the Arctic Entries stage.
All right, so this story goes all the way back to sixth grade. I was going to a whole new school, an entire new country, and it was pretty nerve-wracking, I'm gonna be honest. And at the time, I was very shy and insecure of myself, and also a talking meatball. I was pretty chubby back then. And in sixth grade, at the end of sixth grade, I realized how much I hated the fact that I was very shy and insecure because I didn't have any connections or friends. So it's a horrible feeling. It's very depressing. So I put myself a goal to change, to completely change who I was back then, someone totally different. And I started on the summer of 2013, and I started with my physical appearance because I thought that was like my biggest obstacle that stopped me from achieving that goal. So I pretty much told my body to stop growing from the sides and just rise up, and it worked out. I don't know how it did, but it did. I'm still figuring out. I don't know if it was magic, aliens, or puberty, but it did. So, thank you. And I was ready. I was going to seventh grade, and I was pumped. I felt like a total new, a different person. I felt ready. I felt confident. But little that I knew was that right when I went to seventh grade, I was still the same shy, insecure little boy I was in sixth grade. And I thought it was just going to be another year of sixth grade, and I hated that. I was like, well, here it goes again. Great. And halfway through the year of seventh grade, I met this person, this girl, and her name is Camelia. And no, this is not a love story, but yeah. I met this person that she came up to me at the time. I would always come up to people and make them sort of try to be their friends, but it never worked out. But for the first time ever, she was the first person who ever came up to me to become my friend, and I loved that. It was amazing. And not only that, she was everything I wanted to be. She was amazing. She was friendly. She was funny. She was secure of herself, and she knew English. Like, mind blown. And at the time, she was my goal. I want to be her. I want to be Camelia. I want to be her. So I would start just following her, taking notes of everything she did. And yeah, in other words, stalking her. But you know, you do everything you can to achieve your goals. And so I did. It doesn't matter. And yeah, seventh grade was over, and the summer goes by, and eighth grade is right around the corner. So right before eighth grade, my parents find out about this awesome thing that the school provides to students, and it was sports. And I didn't know about that because I was just a chubby little boy who barely knew or cared enough about sports. So I was like, hey, that's cool. All right, I'm going to try it. Why not? So I tried for cross country, which, by the way, was the worst choice I could have ever gotten because I had just gotten out of my obesity problem. Then they make me run these 2-mile races. Like, nope. But, you know, I made the best out of it, and at the end it was fun. So yeah. And at the beginning of cross country, they made us go into the lunchroom, just kind of get a feeling of the people who were going to be on the team, and sort of like that. I don't know why, really, but we went in, and I was last because I didn't know where it was. So right when I come into the doors, I get this great feeling of just such positivity and just so many connections and people sharing in groups and everyone being friendly. I love that. It was amazing. But right after that feeling, after seeing all that, I get back to the feeling of sixth grade, when I was lonely and depressed, and I got shy and insecure again. I was like, well, this is just like a mini sixth grade. Great, again, awesome. And but this time, I wasn't gonna accept it. I determined myself to do something about it. So I was like, okay, you're not gonna stand still. You're gonna do something about it. So I thought back to my first best friend, Camelia. And I was like, how did we become friends? It surely wasn't through communications because I didn't know any English, so it wasn't through that. And I remember it was through a high five, a simple high five. And I was like, okay, if it worked with her, it surely has to work with everyone else. So there you see me just having the thought of going up to people and just high-five them, hopefully it would work. And one out of these two things could have happened. People would either think of me as the creepy little boy who wanted to physically touch you for no freaking reason, or as the kid who wanted to be your friend and just wanted to be part of something bigger than himself. And what do you think? It actually worked out. It just worked out. I started giving people high fives, just pa 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 pa. After that, just friends, 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 friends. It was amazing. Everything started connecting. And the best thing about it was that after that, everything's starting just, I don't know, coming together by on its own. Like you put a piece and all the other pieces just come together on their own. That's how I was, because through a high five, how I see it is, when I give people a high five, I can tell whether I can trust those people or not. Like if they give you a high five like that, it's just nah. It has to be a solid high five. So when I get that, I can tell when I can trust those people. Kind of like The Matrix. I don't know if you've seen that movie. You just transfer all the information. So once I do that, I can trust those people and I can be myself. So when I was being myself, my confidence raised, and not only that, my English raised, and everything just came together with the high five. So yeah, it was great. And right after that, it was awesome. What else? Brain fart. So it took 2 years. I finally achieved my goal. It took 2 years, but you know, I did it, and that's what really matters. And I had done it. I had became the person who I'm proudly today. I had, in other words, became Camellia. So thank you.
That was Juan Martinez Paredes on stage at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kendall Stormo.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Next, we'll hear from Oscar Avellaneda Cruz. He's a photographer here in Anchorage, and he's going to take us back to his high school days.
So this story begins way back in 98 when, on the first day of school as a freshman, I walk into my high school history class. It's the end of the day, and I already feel out of place because it's the last day of school. So naturally, where do you go? You sit in the back of the class, because if you feel like you don't fit in, that's where you go. I look to my right, and there's this tall guy who's stretched out sitting in his desk. We look at one another, say nothing to each other, and we both already know we're friends. Ian and I, when we discovered photography in high school, it became like the perfect mutual hobby to spend time with. Not just because you could turn your bedroom into dark rooms, but because you could also have a perfect excuse to try anything and push past your like comfort zones. I remember when Ian got his driver's license at 16, we would cruise around with a police scanner in the car and trying to find fires to take photos of and get Anchorage Daily News to buy the film and develop it. It never worked out, but we tried nonetheless. And when he got me a job at the portrait studio where he worked in the mall, we'd stay late after work and dress up in props and just have these impromptu photo shoots for no reason really, just to kind of make believe and have characters. And it didn't really matter what we did. The whole idea was Ian and I created a sense of like space so we could both explore who we were becoming. Thinking back to those days, I consistently remember there's like a soundtrack of 90s indie rock. Think Nirvana, Sublime, Radiohead, and especially Smashing Pumpkins. See, at the time, I'm a total pumpkin fanatic. I can't get enough of quirky Billy Corgan voice. And there's this one song, 33, that almost every time it comes on, I have this desire to have deeper philosophical conversation. So I'd ask Ian questions like, Ian, if you could be any animal in the world, what animal would you be? And Ian, who do you think we'll be, and what will the world be like when we're 33? And as we grew up, these adventures only got that much more ridiculous because we basically just had more resources and time, and we were liable for our own actions. In fact, this very theater, when we were finally 18, we helped our friends set up microphones for the Anchorage Symphony. So I have memories with Ian everywhere. And when we got into four buying, my dad was a mechanic, and so I rebuilt a 68 FJ Cruiser, and we headed out to King River. He had his like FJ60 from the 80s. And my vehicle died halfway between Anchorage and Palmer, and we hopped in his and headed out to the trail. And on the trail, we broke the steering knuckle of his truck, so then we had to try to fix it with what we had and then get back into the vehicle. And when he moved away out of state, we still stayed in contact through long phone calls. And when he offered to cover my hotel in Vegas when he lived there, I flew down with pretty much like $0 in my bank account, but Ian at the time was gambling and he had a great poker face. He totally could play poker. Me, on the other hand, I could not. So I played the $5 and $10 roulette tables and I did pretty well. Like for 4 days, I basically covered meals and entertainment. And all this changed because in May 12th of 2016, I was sitting on the front porch of my home having dinner. And at the time, my wife gets a phone call from my brother who says, "Come quick, Ian has only hours to live." See, what had happened was that Ian was diagnosed with cancer at the turn of the year. And this diagnosis had basically brought our friendship to a whole new level because we'd found a whole new level of vulnerability with one another. We were now having conversations that were basically about living intentionally and planning what it'd be like to live after treatment. We'd even gone as far as to plan what I call the recovery route, the idea that we were going to use Powerline Pass and weekly walks together to create a metric of how much stronger and healthier Ian was getting. And this was extremely symbolic to me because Ian was the friend who introduced me to the Chugach. You know, growing up here since the age of 3, I just thought there were mountains, but no, Ian's like, "Let's go play in the mountains." So when that didn't turn out to be the case, that evening I was in a home with close friends and his family and playing Smashing Pumpkins from my phone and sharing with other friends and family equally amazing stories of Ian adventures. Fast forward a few months later, I'm working at the Anchorage Museum as a photographer to document a one-time ceremony of these 10 really large masks. The ceremony is going to basically transform the masks from their world, from the world we live in, into the spirit world through the process of fire. Each of the masks represented a disease that had affected society, including cancer. And they were created by Drew Michael, who's Yupik, and Elizabeth Ellis, who's a Lutik. And I remember as I walked through the museum, because it started the atrium, this was open to the public, that I found myself terribly distracted the whole time, because as I'd go between photographing and sort of being aware of the environment, what you do as a photographer, I'd also have this emotional stress about needing to track where Ian's mask was. And in between, I'd hug friends and say hi to people. And it wasn't until the masks were carried out by the public out to the front lawn that I realized I might not be able to do my job as a photographer because I needed to say goodbye to my friend. And after the ceremonial dance out front in the lawn, the masks made their way down to the now lit fire pits. I remember moving around, and as a photographer, you kind of get used to going in and out of your senses, and I lose my sense of hearing when I'm doing certain kinds of assignments. And the only thing that was different this time was that I noticed I was also really shallow of breathing. And so that's when I realized I need to find my way to Ian's mask. So I made my way over, and by this point, Drew and Liz had now released like 5 of the masks. And I put my camera down, and I remember kneeling, and I reached out to the mask, and I said, "Ian, thank you. Thank you for being an amazing friend. I love you." And it was at that moment that the volunteer who was standing right over the mask turned over to me and said, "I think you should be here." And just like that, we switched places. And when Drew came by, he and I both picked up this mask and we released it to the fire. And I still don't have words to describe the emotional release that I felt, because over the course of this year, I had not only lost a friend, but my marriage had ended. And I had also been assaulted, and I had come to understand what it was like to live with PTSD. But it was there in tears that I realized part of my journey in healing is actually sharing and being open. And I know that Ian would get an absolute kick out of this story because today I turned 33.
That was Oscar Avellaneda Cruz, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA.
Our next storyteller is Wendy Smithwood. She's a homesteader out on Sheep Mountain with her husband Richard and husky Nick. She's also an adventurous travel and mountain guide.
During the winter months, she leads trips for Alaskans to Britain, France, and Morocco. Here she is on the Arctic Entries stage.
In 1996, I arrived at a Moscow airport at midnight with £30,000 sterling strapped to my stomach. In today's money, that's $70,000. I was a mountain guide at the time, working for a firm in London, and I was about to go for a season in the big mountains of Central Asia. I was going via Moscow to meet with the agency who were going to support us, hence other money, and the 8 duffel bags of mountaineering equipment I had to drag with me. I arrive, leaving London, one clear warning. Whatever you do in Moscow or in an airport, do not get in a taxi. You will never reach your destination. You'll be mugged, you'll be robbed, and you might be killed. This had happened a lot at this time. We were 8 years after the war, and it was still the Soviet bloc. It really felt like it. I come into the arrivals hall, and there's no one to meet me. It's now 1 a.m. I have no friends, no language, don't speak Russian, my first visit to Russia, and one contact number. I call, I leave messages, nothing. The arrivals hall is this huge concrete hall, nothing fancy, white tile, very seedy concrete floors, pillars, no cafes, no chairs, almost no people. And a few seedy, petty criminal types hanging around. I pile my bags up against a pillar, and I'm standing there, and I'm feeling very tired, very vulnerable, kind of pissed, and the money is burning a hole in my stomach. I knew that the few people in the black leather trenches, the black bomber jackets, and the hats who were giving me the eye, I knew that they knew that I didn't have anybody or any resources. And I had this sense that something was going to happen soon, that someone was going to take me down. There was a wall of glass, and outside it was chucking it down with rain. There was a row of taxis right there. And I had this tension between standing at the pillar for the rest of the night until somebody came to find me, or watching these guys figure out that they could take me. A man comes directly at me, eye contact. He's really smartly dressed. He's in a cream trench coat, smart, well-groomed, has a briefcase, shiny shoes, and he comes directly at me and he says, "Are you in trouble? Do you need help?" And I realize I have to make a decision right there to admit publicly my vulnerability and be at his mercy, or say, "No, I'm fine, I'll just stay here." And I decide to trust him. He looks great. I tell him that I haven't been met and I don't know what to do. He says, "Do you want me to help you find a hotel?" And I say, "Yes, please." So he goes and gets a taxi, we pile all my stuff in. He gets in the front with the Russian cab driver and I get in the back seat, all my stuff's in the boot and in the seat with me. And we pull away from the airport. As we get out of the lights, we're in a very narrow road, a long corridor of trees, spruce trees, the cones of the car, the lashing rain, and very black and white, very Funeral in Berlin, Michael Caine, spies, Soviets. And we're as we get into this wilderness of trees and leave the lights of the airport behind, I realize I'm in the taxi with two guys. I'm outnumbered, and I have no idea where we're going. Eventually, 20 minutes later, we come to the edge of Moscow, the lights of the city. Huge, big warehouse buildings, 3 blocks long, 5 stories high, and narrow streets, hardly any light anywhere. And cobbles were bouncing. And we stop, it's still raining cats and dogs, and my friend says, I'll check. He comes out into the building, back out, there isn't any room, and I think, how can there not be any room in there? We go on, and the streets get narrower. Eventually, there's big industrial lighting, chain link fences, barbed wire, and as we bounce over some railroad tracks into a railroad siding, a sea of discarded railroad carriages, I know this is the place I'm going to die. And I grab my rucksack, and I'm looking inside this little larder. I'm looking for the latch of the door, and I'm going to throw myself out. We come around the corner, and there's a red velvet awning and a light and a neat set of wooden steps into a perfect wood-paneled foyer. And my friend jumps out and he says, checks, comes back, he says, they have a room. And this sea of railway cars is a hotel. They're all connected, sleeper cars. He says, there's only one room. And I'm like, uh-huh, this is the payment somehow. And I think, well, you're not dead, so that's one good thing. We drag our stuff down the narrow corridors of these sleeper cars, and we come into an immaculately clean sleeper carriage, two bunks, bunk. And he gets onto the lower bunk in very gentlemanly fashion, and I get onto the top, and I'm lying there like this, thinking, oh, let's wait for something to happen. Nothing happens. I hardly get any sleep. In the morning, he buys me breakfast. He calls the agency. He totally regales them for abandoning me. He tells me about his life in Siberia and his family in the Urals, and I am safely reunited with the agency who are going to look after me in Moscow. And I realized that the man who for one moment was going to kill me actually saved my bacon. Thank you for listening.
That was Wendy Smith Wood, and this has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
To hear these stories again or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org.
The Arctic Entries website also has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you could tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard and the storytellers for this show, all of whom are volunteers, by the way.
The proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. Information about this is also on our site.
Thanks to our audio engineer, Robert Stormo, and thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Rosie Robards.
And I'm Kendall Stormo. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
Where will we go? What will we be? I want to be yours, but I want to be free. What will we do when times get tough? Improve our life or play from the rough? I love the start of new things to come. And I love your lips, wanna give me some. Will we fuss and fight when things go wrong? Will we laugh and sing every day a new song?